content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the January 9th, 2026 online edition of the New Yorker. Is life a game? In The Score, the philosopher C. T. Nguyen argues that play is the meaning of life, by Joshua Rothman. Every summer for the past few years, I've taught a multi-day seminar for philosophy professors who want to write for magazines. The seminars involve a fair amount of after-dinner chit-chat under the stars, during which talk often winds its way to the weirdness of being a professional philosopher. It turns out, for instance, that philosophy departments are ruled by rankings. A single website, the Philosophical Gourmet, ranks graduate programs in philosophy, sorting them out not just in general terms, NYU, Rutgers, and Princeton are currently the top three, but by specialization. Oxford wins for normative ethics, the University of Toronto for American pragmatism. The rankings are based on a survey which asked philosophy professors to rate one another, and its effects, people say, are widespread. One professor told me that it's not unusual for hiring decisions to take the rankings into account. In theory, no one cares about them, but any given department knows that, if it brings on the right philosopher, it could dominate Chinese philosophy or own the Nietzsche space. Philosophers are supposed to be clear thinkers. Shouldn't they see through thought traps like this? The problem is that metrics are seductive. Once something is being ranked, it becomes almost impossible to get that ranking out of your head. Over time, this can lead to what C. T. Nguyen calls value capture. In The Score, How to Stop Playing Somebody Else's Game, Nguyen writes that value capture occurs when you get your values from some external source and let them rule you without adapting them. Because we live in a world in which nearly everything is quantified and ranked, value capture is everywhere. Nguyen teaches philosophy at the University of Utah and is appropriately into rock climbing. When he first took up the sport, what he loved was the feeling of climbing, the joy of using his body in new, challenging, even elegant ways to scale walls of rock. He quickly learned that routes have difficulty scores. These were useful because they motivated him. But soon he started chasing higher scores. He began thinking that the point of rock climbing was to conquer increasingly demanding routes. I wanted that next number so badly, he writes. The more desperately I wanted it, the grosser my climbing got. His values had been captured, and he hauled himself to the top by any means necessary. It wasn't until he saw another climber summit a route, judge his own climbing as ugly, and then reclimb it more beautifully, that Nguyen remembered what had drawn him to climbing in the first place. He stopped chasing higher scores and focused on enjoying the climb itself. This act, looking away from the score in search of some unmeasured value that actually matters to us, can be surprisingly difficult. Our actual values are often unclear, Nguyen writes. A lot of the time, we don't know the real reason we're doing something. You enjoy cooking and want to improve, so you buy a few cookbooks. Before you know it, you're attempting a 20-ingredient bœuf bourguignon. Your values have been captured by foodie metrics, which dictate that more complicated food is better. You love traveling and begin planning an international vacation. You end up overstuffing your trip, dashing from one can't-miss destination to another. Your values have been captured by leisure influencers who have persuaded you that a successful trip involves doing it all. What does make a meal or a trip successful? It's hard to say. This is one of the reasons that you can see value capture happening and be almost powerless to stop it. For many years, until I started writing this column, I was an editor at The New Yorker. I've now given up my editorial duties. But because no one deactivated my login, I still have access to the magazine's traffic software, which lets me see exactly how many people read my columns. I know very well that the value of a given piece of writing is not reflected in how many people read it. Even so, I can't help but check on the leaderboard to see how my articles chart, and feel satisfaction and desolation when my numbers surge or plummet. The stats are so much more concrete than my internal, unarticulated writerly goals. There's a paradox here. Goals, rankings, and metrics help us thrive. Without them, we'd be lazy and unable to compare, coordinate, and connect our efforts. We can't live by intuition alone. At the same time, there's almost always a gap between what's being measured and what actually matters, Nguyen writes. It might even be the case that many of the important things in life seem to consistently defy measurement. So how do we measure what we do without misleading ourselves? How can we use rankings without letting them rule us? There are lots of ways we could answer these questions, and Nguyen approaches them through games. In his previous book, Games, Agency as Art, a philosophical smash hit which won the American Philosophical Association's Book Prize in 2021, he argued that games let us flirt with different modes of agency. A pacifist in real life becomes a military strategist at the chessboard. Playing poker, you might proudly deceive your spouse. In The Score, Nguyen extends these ideas. Games, he writes, can train us to focus on value by teaching us the distinction between goals and purposes. When you're playing charades with your family, your goal is to win. But your purpose is to be part of a group of people enjoying themselves. For this reason, as long as you have a good time, you can feel satisfied even if you lose. It would be bizarre to get mad about losing at charades. In order to enjoy the game, however, you must also take winning seriously. You have to commit temporarily to its values, not just to the value of winning, but to values like being demonstrative, extroverted, and unselfconscious. There are players for whom goal and purpose are identical. They pursue what Nguyen calls achievement play. Professional athletes, for example, play games to win and believe deeply in the glory of victory. But most of us pursue striving play, in which you try to win not because winning is important, but because the act of trying to win gives you a delicious struggle. This involves an interior balancing act. A striving player doesn't want a game to be too easy. There would be no struggle. Or too hard. There'd be no winning. She might find the sweet spot by putting handicaps in place or tweaking the rules. But the struggle can't be allowed to take precedence either. It can be the purpose, but not the goal. And Nguyen recalls a friend who found that his 10-year-old son was beating him in Monopoly. The game dragged on until the dad discovered that his son was reverse cheating by sneaking cash back to him. The son hoped to prolong his victorious game for as long as possible. But you cannot be a rock climber who doesn't care about getting to the top. You have to strive. Broadly, Nguyen thinks that we can draw lessons from game playing as we try to navigate a reality ruled by rankings and metrics. In the real world, as in the game world, scores are motivating and clarifying. They can help groups of people coalesce around shared goals. But real-world scores, like game scores, are also reductive. In both cases, that's the point, as it were, of having a score. a group of people playing charades may come to the game with different purposes. Bob wants to break the ice. Anne wants to flirt. Steve wants to show off his acting chops. Jill is competitive. But the score helps them form a quick, artificial community around the shared and simplified goal of winning. Similarly, the writers, editors, producers, and business people who work at a magazine all can agree, for purposes of decision making, that it's good when a story finds lots of readers and orient their efforts around that goal. But they must also be clear about their individual purposes, which are different, nuanced, and harder to communicate. If they focus only on the score, they'll lose track of what counts. Take this thinking to the extreme. Suppose that the world is run by groups of people who succeed through coordination, by agreeing on shared goals. These goals may be reductive, but they're still useful. And the more that people agree on them, the more coordinated everyone becomes. Over time, we learn to talk in the same ways about the same things. We come to agree, for example, that a great recipe is one that's received tens of thousands of likes online. That attractive people look a certain way with tens at the top. That particular neighborhoods place higher in coolness than other neighborhoods. In all sorts of official and unofficial ways, we are ranking and sorting. And the more we do this, the more we keep doing it, since everything outside the realm of ranking seems a little mysterious. Those unliked recipes, ordinary-looking people, and unfamous neighborhoods, aren't they just mid, forgettable, and random? In Nguyen's view, something like this is happening to our society. He is not only a serious game player. In the score, he ambles through discussions of board games, video games, party games, and the like, but also a devotee of pastimes such as skateboarding, cooking, and yo-yo. It's interesting, he writes, to see what happens when scores are introduced into activities where they've previously been absent. He finds, for instance, that scorekeeping has pushed skateboarders to focus more on obvious badass tricks than on steez, or stylish ease, which is more difficult to quantify. He suggests that the advent of scores for wine has made bold, fruity wines more popular at the expense of subtler ones, which might pair better with food. It's not that these developments have made skateboarding and wine worse as such. Kickflips and fruity wines can be great. But that they have decreased the variety of ways in which excellence can be experienced. Purposes exist in players, not games, and yet the games have come to dominate the players. For Nguyen, rock climbing is about the feeling of moving up the wall, and yet someone else may find the same activity rewarding in a different way. The more we standardize our experience and stress goals over purposes, the less variety we cultivate. Are we, in fact, living in a more standardized society? My own sense is that the truth is twistier. We do seem to be tracking, ranking, rating, and scoring everything. But we're also in a golden age of nicheness, in which consensus culture is fracturing and subcultures are proliferating. Everyone is part of one big network. Consequently, online, you can learn about almost any interest you can imagine. Nguyen shares some cool yo-yo videos on YouTube for the curious. But at the end of every rabbit hole, you'll find other seekers who share your interest. Once people get together, of course, they start to coordinate. They try to figure out which yo-yo tricks are best. They even begin discussing specialized tricks and trying to figure out what makes them cool. Niches grow, people discover them, and standardization unfolds fractally. In this world, standardization is not the only problem. There's also a feeling of crowdedness, a sense of cacophony. For Nguyen, one way to find meaning is to pursue your own purposes, without feeling a need to explain them in terms of goals others can understand. Why does he love the subtle tricks created by the Japanese yo-yo master Tsukasa Takatsu? It's hard to explain, he writes, but that doesn't matter. When I am not forced to perpetually justify myself to other people in terms they can understand, when I am at play, that's enough. As the book concludes, he imagines that we might steer ourselves in the direction of whatever activities grant us our preferred sense of meaning, using the games we share as routes to private fulfillment. It's a strikingly atomized, individualistic endpoint for a book about games, which are almost always social. But it makes sense. Maybe in a world where everyone's a gamer, you just want to play by yourself. Next, from the January 6, 2026 online edition of The New Yorker, what a viral YouTube video says about the future of journalism. A streamer's investigation of fraud in Minnesota garnered millions of views. His content was questionable, but his methods will likely inspire scores of imitators. By J. Caspian Kang. Who is more likely to uphold journalism's ideals of uncovering inconvenient truths, holding the powerful to account, and writing the first draft of history? A handful of decaying, unwieldy legacy news organizations, or a million YouTubers? Nick Shirley, a 23-year-old YouTuber whose investigation into millions of dollars of alleged daycare fraud in Minneapolis has drawn praise from Elon Musk, J.D. Vance, and Kash Patel, the FBI director, might look, at first glance, like the future of journalism. In a video posted on X the day after Christmas, Shirley combines two of the foundational modes of live streaming circa 2025, the man on the street interview and the thrill-seeking adventure into an unknown and ostensibly dangerous place, whether the Mongolian steppe or a tent encampment in Philadelphia, to produce a roughly hour-long narrative. He adopts the role of a guy who simply wants to know more about a problem, going from daycare center to daycare center in Minnesota, and asking the people who work there, all of whom are of Somali origin, if they are the ones stealing taxpayer money. In Shirley's most viral scene, which has been clipped and shared millions of times, he walks up to a storefront with a misspelled sign reading Quality Learning Center, rather than Quality Learning Center. According to Shirley's investigative partner for the video, a man whom he refers to only as David, this daycare has been licensed to care for 99 children and received $4 million in taxpayer funding. In a surreal moment, Shirley and David are confronted by a woman in the parking lot who mistakes them for federal immigration agents and starts yelling to anyone who might be inside, "Don't open up! You have ICE here!" To which Shirley responds, "How do you have ICE here, ma'am? I'm literally a YouTuber." The rest of the video is more of the same. Shirley walks into buildings, sometimes under the guise of trying to enroll his fictional son, Little Joey, into the daycare, and then interviews the people he finds there, whether workers or random passersby. If you're among the credulous who believe there's no political motivation behind Shirley's reporting, there's a thrill to watching all this unfold, especially because Shirley presents himself as just some dude on a quest for the truth. He is quite talented in this role, for what it's worth. The best on-camera investigators often come across as Shirley does, curious, a bit slow, and pathologically stubborn about asking the same questions over and over. After Shirley posted the video, the Minneapolis Star Tribune visited the same daycare centers and also combed through court filings and state enforcement records. They found no evidence of fraud, although a few of the centers had incurred other violations, particularly Quality Learning Center, which the Star Tribune notes has been cited for multiple safety violations. This does not mean that the daycare fraud has not taken place in Minneapolis. There's a years-long history of such malfeasance, and both state and federal law enforcement have convicted dozens of offenders, as Kash Patel subsequently pointed out. But the reason that we, and I mean Shirley, know that this has been going on for a while is because local news outlets have, indeed, reported on it. Last week, the Republican Speaker of the Minnesota House of Representatives said that her caucus had worked with Shirley to point out daycares to visit, a claim that raises questions about whether Shirley really was just a YouTuber on an independent search for the truth, or if he could have been acting on behalf of the Minnesota State GOP. On X, Shirley insisted that this was completely false, adding, "I have no idea who this lady is." Over the weekend, The Intercept published a piece pointing to evidence that the man called David in the video is David Hoch, whom The Intercept identified as a political operative with connections to the Minnesota State House. A few days later, the Trump administration paused federal payments to daycares around the country, a policy that will affect countless children and families. Was this a good faith attempt by the government to root out fraud, which they learned about from Shirley? Or are Republicans simply using this moment to cut yet another federal spending program? After all, as Patel noted, the FBI had been aware of fraud in Minnesota for years. Journalism is not a patent office. You don't get credit only for being first. And Shirley, for better or worse, has shown a giant spotlight on an ongoing story, which has led to the things that journalists often want out of their stories. More of the public was informed about a problem, and the powers supposedly responsible were held to account. On Monday, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, who has borne much of the public blame for failing to prevent fraud in the state, announced he would not be running for a third term, saying he needed to use his time defending the people of Minnesota against the criminals who prey on our generosity and the cynics who prey on our differences. On X, Shirley wrote, "I ended Tim Walz." Whether Minnesota has done enough to address that fraud can and should be a point of debate. I suppose it's also worth asking if the story had garnered enough national attention, though I'm not sure why fraud in Minnesota would be headline news across the country. But what Shirley and his cheerleaders have suggested is that he uncovered this fraud on his own because liberals and the government and the media were covering it up. Musk spent the better part of 2 days reposting reactions to the video, some of them falsely claiming that nearly every prominent news organization, The Times, CNN, Washington Post, had failed to report at all prior to Shirley's video on the Minnesota fraud story. The implication was that the woke media wants to protect criminal immigrants and feckless liberal politicians, most notably Walz, who supposedly let all this take place. Musk, who owns X, wants to promote the belief that the truth can be found on social media and that the practitioners of real journalism are allegedly independent amateurs, such as Shirley, who can ask questions without being cowed by the woke agenda. Shirley's video gained a lot of traction because it was promoted by some of the most powerful and followed accounts on social media, but it went mega viral because of its form. It's true that local and national news reported on fraud in Minnesota, but there is nothing quite like watching a secret get revealed on video, especially if you believe that everyone is trying to suppress it. The reality is that traditional investigative journalism is a frequently boring and frustrating endeavor that takes a lot of time, money, and patience. A lot of effort is expended tracking down paperwork from public records requests or looking through LinkedIn profiles to find people who might have worked together or knocking on the doors of potential sources. When the work is done and enters the world, there's a decent chance that the reporting garners relatively little attention. Print media outlets, At least the types of places that can still afford investigative desks are often sclerotic, quasi-puritanical institutions that discourage their practitioners from too much self-promotion or marketing. Television news has always had a different approach to investigative work, attempting to engineer dramatic confrontations between the person or institution under scrutiny and the intrepid reporter. Local news has dined out for decades on the spectacle of the journalist marching into the shady business and demanding why the frozen meat has been stored in a mop bucket or whatever. National networks, for their part, have produced news magazine shows that specialize in filming similarly dramatic face-to-face encounters. During 3 years as a television news correspondent, I quickly learned that the point of everything I did was to make the person sitting across from me as uncomfortable as possible. In the past few years, this approach has made its way to YouTube, Twitch, and the other live streaming sites. The vast majority of political content online is still commentary, running the full gamut from the socialist Hassan Piker to the white nationalist Nick Fuentes. But a handful of creators, like Shirley, have turned the tropes of the TV news investigation into millions of streaming views. The style, credibility, and sanity of these programs vary widely. Candace Owens, for example, has investigated everything from the assassination of Charlie Kirk to whether Emmanuel Macron's wife is actually a man. Owens mostly does her talking from behind a desk. Shirley, though, uses techniques that resemble the popular and notorious reality show To Catch a Predator from the mid-2000s, on which the host, Chris Hansen, would confront potential sexual predators. And he has aped the look and feel of Michael Moore's intimate, low-budget documentary Roger and Me from 1989. Moore's documentary, like Shirley's viral video, mostly features a casually dressed man talking to people in a Midwestern city during winter. The seemingly authenticity of that formula perfectly serves the social media narrative that the truth can come only from streamers and YouTubers. This insurrectionary narrative about the media is not restricted to the right. In the world of sports, Pablo Torre, who spent more than a decade at ESPN, has captivated fans with his own version of the video investigation. CoffeeZilla, a YouTuber with more than 4 million subscribers, regularly uncovers scams, as he puts it. An important demystifying truth has been revealed through all of this. Investigative journalism is mostly about persistence, and it can, in fact, be done by amateurs, sometimes carefully and well, and sometimes not. Just as the streaming and TikTok booms flooded the streets of New York City with hundreds of aspiring influencers who asked passersby what they did for a living or who rated passersby on a scale of 1 to 10, Shirley and his fellow independent journalist will likely inspire others to turn themselves into one-man local documentary news units. In the week following Shirley's viral video, a host of copycats went out to daycare facilities around the country and posted their own videos. They tended to be even less thorough than Shirley, who at least had David around to show some paperwork. Everything from blacked-out windows, which, as anyone with children in a major city knows, are common for daycares, to empty facilities on New Year's Eve were presented as supposed proof of fraud and corruption. I imagine these gonzo investigations will propagate and that by summer we will see thousands of Nick Shirleys asking questions about small business loans, public school funding, and the moon landing. Some will be scrupulous, others will broker in conspiracy and flagrant lies. But most will probably look something like Shirley's synthesis of TikTok, TV News, and Michael Moore. There is something inherently arresting about watching a poorly dressed, insistent person barging into places where they're not invited, particularly if you think they are uncovering something that will dovetail exactly with your political beliefs. What's more, The people in charge of actual institutions of power, the vice president, the FBI director, the attorney general, seem hell-bent on having Nick Shirley, or someone like him, replace the legacy media. This past weekend, Shirley and a host of other right-wing independent media accounts shared images that allegedly showed Venezuelans in the streets celebrating the capture of President Nicolas Maduro by American armed forces. Many of these images were either AI-generated or taken from some other event entirely. Shirley posted a video of a handful of happy people in Miami and wrote, "World Cup-style celebrations are erupting all across Venezuela. Congratulations to the people of Venezuela." Before we hail the glory of independent media and toss those crotchety investigative reporters and editors to the unemployment lines, I would ask again the question that began this column, slightly rephrased this time. Do a million YouTube investigators actually constitute a freer media, or are they more likely to bend with the political winds blown by the most powerful people in this country, who seem eager to prop up an endless self-generating supply of content creators as the next font of truth? In this media environment, the government doesn't even have to produce its own propaganda. It simply needs to direct the public to someone who is already doing the job for them. And now, from the January 8, 2026 online edition of The New Yorker, why Donald Trump wants Greenland and everything else. There is no Trump doctrine, just a map of the world that the president wants to write his name on in big gold letters, by Susan B. Glasser. In the fall of 2021, I flew down to Mar-a-Lago with my husband, Peter Baker, the chief White House correspondent at the Times, to interview Donald Trump for a book we were writing on his first term in office. After an hour and a half, an aide moved to the end of the conversation, but we threw in one last question. Why had he pursued the purchase of the Danish territory of Greenland, to the shock of European allies and the general bemusement of much of the American public? Trump presented his interest as the musings of a canny businessman. "I said, why don't we have that? You take a look at a map, so I'm in real estate. I look at a corner. I say, I got to get that store for the building that I'm building, etc. You know, it's not that different. I love maps, and then I always said, look at the size of this. It's massive, and that should be part of the United States," he added. "It's not different from a real estate deal. It's just a little bit larger, to put it mildly." Greenland was hardly headline news at that point. We had asked Trump about it because, in conducting interviews for the book, we had been surprised to learn that his pursuit of it had not been the transitory whim that it had initially appeared to be when, in the summer of 2019, it was first made public, but a persistent demand over several years of his presidency. Several former officials had told us that Trump's insistence had prompted serious internal study. Trump's college friend, the cosmetics magnate and philanthropist Ronald Lauder, had planted the idea with the president, we were told, and even presented himself to Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, as a possible secret envoy to Denmark. In the summer of 2018, according to Bolton, Trump mused about trading Puerto Rico for Greenland. After an early Oval Office meeting during which Trump expounded on buying Greenland, another mystified cabinet member was struck by how delusional the president sounded. "You just sit there and be like, well, this isn't real," the secretary later told us. "But then you're like, oh, well, maybe this is real in his mind." At the time, our interest in the episode was more historical than geopolitical. Trump himself was exiled in Florida, a political outcast. Joe Biden's foreign policy was all about reinforcing America's commitment to its allies in Europe, such as Denmark, and repudiating Trump's undermining of the U.S.-led international order. But just a few years later, we now know that Trump's pursuit of Greenland will not end up as it should have, an obscure footnote to the story of a failed one-term president. On Tuesday, giddy after the success of a daring weekend raid to capture the Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro, Trump's White House put out a statement threatening Denmark, a NATO ally, with military action if it did not hand over Greenland, a threat so reminiscent of Vladimir Putin's bald demands in the run-up to his invasion of Ukraine that it had Russian officials openly cheering. In the days since, Trump has insisted that the United States simply must have the vast, sparsely populated, and resource-rich territory. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is set to meet with Denmark's leaders next week to present terms. Seven European nations put out a joint statement condemning the threats, leading to yet another Trump statement claiming that it was the Europeans who could not be trusted to defend their fellow alliance members. What some of Trump's own senior officials once viewed as the delusional musings of a dilettante have now become a genuine international crisis, one that could lead, or maybe it already has led, to the effective end of NATO. After this week, is there anyone who can credibly claim to be sure that the United States, under Trump, would honor the commitment to mutual defense that is the foundation of the alliance? Greenland, it turns out, is not a punchline, but a template that explains much about Trump's foreign policy. It's about a power-grabbing president who looks at territory on a map and says he wants to own it. Trump could not articulate a rationale for acquiring Greenland, quote, from a strategic standpoint, from a locational standpoint, from a geography standpoint, it's something that we should have, end quote, he told us, any more than he can elaborate on what his plan is for Venezuela now that he's toppled the country's leader and seized some of its oil. Asked by reporters from the New York Times on Wednesday why he couldn't just settle for the terms of the existing 1951 treaty with Denmark, which grants the U.S. military nearly unlimited use of Greenland's territory, Trump replied, ownership is very important. And then he added, because that's what I feel is psychologically needed for success. There are no limits to his global powers, Trump said, except one thing, my own morality, my own mind. It's the only thing that can stop me. Trump's approach to the world is not the isolationism that many of his supporters celebrated when he returned to the White House, vowing an American first shift away from the liberal internationalism of his predecessors, but a narcissistic form of unilateralism that says loudly, I can do whatever I want, whenever and however I want to do it. Unrestrained power wielded for its own sake is the theme. And, along with Trump himself, his deputy chief of staff, Stephen Miller, is its muse. Miller's snarling enunciation of this doctrine in an interview with CNN's Jake Tapper on Monday, during which he asserted America's right to do as it wished with Greenland, has justifiably been taken as an important statement of the worldview underpinning this administration. We live in a world, the real world, Jake, that is governed by strength, that is governed by force, that is governed by power, Miller said. These are the iron laws of the world since the beginning of time. Counting last week's daring commando raid on Maduro's compound, Trump has now ordered U.S. military attacks on seven different nations since returning to the White House: Iran, Iraq, Nigeria, Somalia, Syria, Venezuela, and Yemen. Trump is tough with the weak, but weak with the tough, as Raphael Glucksmann, a French member of the European Parliament, put it to the Wall Street Journal. Does it make it better or worse that, in most cases, Trump's attention has come and gone as quickly as the missiles he has unleashed? That he has lingered on his military triumphs only long enough to make sweeping claims about the transformative brilliant, incredible results he has achieved before quickly moving on to some other preoccupation. In the days since the Venezuela attack, Trump has explicitly threatened not only Greenland, but also Colombia, Iran, and Mexico. Why? Because he can. And a decade into Trump's political career and nearly a year into his second term, we can now say definitively that the president's signature geopolitical move is not withdrawing the United States from the world, but performative displays of force to impose his will on it. For a man who's also spent the past year proclaiming himself the president of peace, this seems like an almost inconceivable twist. It's not. Trump views these dramatic military actions as standalone accomplishments in their own right. The use of force is, for this president, not so much a means of achieving American national security goals as an end in itself. Trump's reaction to observing the Venezuela attack unfold in real time is worth remembering in the context of an operation that, according to the latest U.S. estimates, killed some 75 people, including both Maduro's security detail and local residents. I mean, I watched it literally like I was watching a television show, he marveled in an interview with Fox News on Saturday. And if you would have seen the speed, the violence, the situation we now find ourselves in of an unrestrained Trump, seemingly intoxicated with the use of military force and determined to swaddle his presidency in its reflected glory, is exactly why Europe is right to fear for Greenland. There are few who think it would take more than a few minutes and a few helicopters for Trump to take possession of it, thus writing himself into history as a leader who remade the map of North America. Those who oppose such a move are left to take comfort in the minor signs of institutional resistance that have emerged in recent days. Those sternly worded European statements, the mumblings of dismay about the president's Greenland threats from 9 Republican senators, and a vote by 5 of them on Thursday to demand that Trump consult Congress before any further military action in Venezuela. As if that would matter. I can remember a time when all 53 Republican senators would have said that the mere hint of an American military attack on Greenland was crazy, outrageous, and in and of itself an impeachable offense. When was this long ago time, you might ask? I can give you a very specific answer. 11:59 a.m. on January 19th of last year. Welcome to 2026. Trump's apologists may be right when they say that the Marshall bluster is no more than a bargaining tactic. It appears that's what Maduro thought, too, right up until the moment Trump sent the Delta Force into his bedroom in the middle of the night. Next, from the January 11th, 2026 online edition of The New Yorker, Denmark is sick of being bullied by Trump. The U.S., once Denmark's closest ally, is threatening to steal Greenland and attacking the country's wind power industry. Is this a permanent breakup? By Margaret Talbot. Once upon a time, before the U.S. began threatening to take over Greenland and treating European democracies as enemies, the Danish politician Ida Auken was a deep admirer of America. Hanging on the wall of her office at the Folketing, the Danish parliament, where she has served since 2007, are framed photographs of 2 U.S. presidents, John F. Kennedy and Barack Obama, both seated in gently curving Danish modern chairs. The images stand out in a setting that otherwise resembles a Scandinavian mood board, a boldly striped black and white couch, modular bookshelves stocked with texts on climate change, red snow boots standing sentinel in a corner. Auken, a gregarious 47-year-old, visited America for the first time as a teenager, attending school for a semester in Charlotte, North Carolina, while living with a local family. Over the years, and especially when she served as her country's environment minister between 2011 and 2014, Alcon regularly traveled to the U.S., and she counts Republicans and Democrats, evangelicals and environmentalists among her many American friends. She even became fond of quoting Ronald Reagan's invocation of the U.S. as a shining city upon a hill. Now, though, some of her constituents were telling her that they were more afraid of the United States than of Russia. For Alcon, the photographs of JFK and Obama have become reminders of the United States I used to look up to. Wistfully, she called them my old friends. Ever since President Donald Trump began his second term, he has resuscitated American imperialism while giddily alienating allies. Canadians have been so infuriated by his tariffs and by his glib pronouncement about making their country the 51st state that they have embraced a vigorous new patriotism. Maple leaf flags everywhere, boycotts of United States goods. Throughout Europe, Trump's upending of trade and climate change agreements has stoked anger and sowed distrust in American global leadership. Still, Denmark presents a special case. Rasmus Gran Bertelsen, a prominent political consultant in Copenhagen, told me that Denmark has probably the most American-friendly country in the EU. Since 9/11, Denmark has adhered to so-called super-Atlanticism, which makes alignment with the U.S. its foreign policy priority. The country sent thousands of troops to serve in both Afghanistan and Iraq. 52 Danish soldiers died in those operations, significant losses in a country with a population of only 6 million. Among NATO allies, Denmark maintained the highest level of popular support for the mission in Afghanistan, even though it sustained the highest number of fatalities per capita. Because of Denmark's unusually close cooperation with U.S. foreign policy, Bertelsen said it has been shocking to see how serious the U.S. now is about ignoring our territorial integrity. Trump's ambition to wrest away Greenland, a semi-autonomous territory within the Danish kingdom, has been a weirdly persistent keynote of his second term, though he floated it in his first. And he talks as if acquiring the Arctic island, which has its own parliament but receives an annual block grant of some $600 million from Denmark, is an inevitability. In speeches and interviews and on Truth Social, Trump has offered variations on the lines, we have to have it, and one way or another we're going to get it. To justify this expansionist rhetoric, he has cited both national security, the island abuts a naval choke point between the Arctic and the Atlantic Oceans, and a need for unfettered access to Greenland's mineral bounty. It has deposits of oil, gas, diamonds, and rare earth minerals, though many caches are trapped beneath glaciers. Perhaps Trump is simply tantalized by its bigness, as he might put it. The territory looks disproportionately large in the Mercator projection, but we probably can't count on Trump's knowing that. In May, the Wall Street Journal reported that the U.S. had increased clandestine intelligence gathering in Greenland. The Danish public broadcaster, DR, subsequently revealed that at least three unnamed Americans tied to Trump were conducting covert influence operations there, such as identifying residents who might join a secession movement. Lars Løkke Rasmussen, Denmark's foreign minister, summoned a top official from the U.S. Embassy in Copenhagen to discuss the allegations, denouncing any attempt to interfere in the internal affairs of the kingdom. In December, Trump appointed Louisiana's Governor Jeff Landry as a special envoy to Greenland. On X, Landry described his mandate bluntly, to make Greenland a part of the U.S. A day after the Trump administration bombed Venezuela and kidnapped its president, Nicolas Maduro, Trump teased what might be next, declaring on Air Force One, "We need Greenland." Katie Miller, a former administration spokesman and the wife of Stephen Miller, the Deputy White House Chief of Staff for Policy, posted on X a map in which Greenland's interior was covered by an American flag. Stephen Miller then joined the fray himself, saying on CNN that nobody's going to fight the United States militarily over the future of Greenland, and that the world is governed not by international niceties, but by strength and force. That day, Secretary of State Marco Rubio told lawmakers not to fret over much. Trump's goal was merely to buy, not to attack, the island. This reassurance was somewhat undercut by a White House statement on Greenland, which noted that the U.S. military is always an option at the commander-in-chief's disposal. The Prime Minister of Denmark, the no-nonsense Social Democrat Mette Frederiksen, and the Prime Minister of Greenland, Jan Frederik Nielsen, have repeatedly insisted that the island will never be for sale and cannot be forcibly annexed, and that territorial integrity is a principle to be respected, especially among allies. On January 5th, Frederiksen told DR, "Unfortunately, I think the American president should be taken seriously when he says he wants Greenland," adding, "I have made it very clear where the Kingdom of Denmark stands." Frederiksen then observed, "If the United States attacks another NATO country, everything stops." This defiance has rallied Danes behind her, though critics have questioned her ability to defend the homeland. On January 5th, the conservative-leaning newspaper Berlingst demanded to know how Danish defense forces would respond to American aggression, asking, "How should Greenlanders react if one day armed Marines walk the streets of Nuuk and the government offices are occupied by Trump's henchmen?" Kenneth Ullenschlager, Buhl, an international law expert and a former naval officer who served for 40 years in the Danish military, including in Iraq and Afghanistan, told me that, according to a Danish decree from 1952, a foreign attack would require the country's military forces to respond to the fullest extent. He noted that any specific defense plans would be kept secret so as not to prompt Trump to act immediately, adding, "That's what I'd be afraid of." The Trump administration has also been undermining Denmark economically, launching a sustained attack on wind power technology, one of the country's major exports. In August, the administration ordered work stopped on Revolution Wind, an offshore wind farm in New England, which is 87% complete, according to its co-developer, the partly state-owned Danish energy company Ørsted. In May, newspapers reported the results of a global opinion study, the Democracy Perception Index, which assessed the attitudes of more than 100,000 people in 100 countries toward other nations, including China, Russia, and the U.S. The net popularity of the United States had fallen from 22 points in 2024 to negative 5. In Denmark, it had fallen to negative 45. Nico Jaspers, whose firm Nira Data helped conduct the polling, told me that he'd been super surprised that regard for the U.S. had fallen so much, so fast. In May, Reuters reported that travel to the U.S. from Denmark had fallen by 19%, and that the U.S. will lose $8.2 billion in spending by foreign tourists in 2025, noting that policy-related concerns and harsh rhetoric had contributed to a negative global travel sentiment about America. Danes have been alarmed by media accounts of European tourists being held in immigrant detention centers. Two young Danish women had reported being taken into federal custody in Hawaii because they had mistakenly obtained the wrong visa for volunteer work they were intending to do on organic farms. The Danish Foreign Ministry, like that of many European countries, issued warnings saying that travelers to the United States might face risks to their safety. Last spring, Dominique Routhier, an art theorist at Roskilde University, turned down a Fulbright fellowship he'd been awarded for a research sabbatical at New York University. In an essay he wrote for the newspaper Politiken, Routhier noted that, quote, "as a white man with his papers in order, he knew that he would run a limited risk by entering the U.S. His goal was to show solidarity with thousands of so-called illegal immigrants, criminals, or political opponents wrongly labeled as terrorists in Trump's America. Meanwhile, Denmark, like other countries in Europe, was attempting to recruit American scientists and academics who had suddenly lost their jobs or research funding, or who felt targeted by the Trump administration because they worked on subjects that it disdained, such as climate change or gender. In an Instagram post in English, the chief executive of the Danish Chamber of Commerce, Brian Mikkelsen, addressed all the brilliant researchers in the U.S. feeling uncertain right now and told them, there is an alternative. In Denmark, we value science. We believe in facts. Trump's antagonism toward Greenland has also changed Danish views about European unity. In the past, Danes had been soft Euroskeptics. They joined the EU in the 1970s, but they kept their own currency, the krone, and in 1992 they voted against the Maastricht Treaty, which tightened European conformity regarding security, citizenship, and other matters. When Frederiksen recently called for more defense spending, she acknowledged European cooperation has never really been a favorite of many Danes. They'd grumbled, she said, about everything from crooked cucumbers and banning plastic straws to open immigration policies. When I returned from Denmark, I kept checking in with Alkan. On the weekend of Trump's Venezuela incursion and Katie Miller's flag post, Alkan sent me an email with the subject line, "The Sentiment in DK." Her message included a forwarded social media post of the Danish flag superimposed on a map of the U.S. The comments below it were full of gallows humor along the lines of, "Vikings were there first, time to reclaim it, LOL. Alkan told me that Trump's threats and insults had been useful in the sense that they had prompted Europe to get its act together, to focus on its own defense, and even pay for it independently. But Alkan added, it's also a matter of recognizing that there are things we can affect and things we can't, including the anti-democratic direction of the United States. Right now, it's better and easier for us to build up Europe, she said. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.